On this episode of Skeptico,
I think what a lot of people are trying to figure out in this consciousness transformation thing that you guys are so much about in terms of Reality Sandwich, that's who you are. They want to know what's real, and they want to know what's real from kind of two angles. I think one side, we get it from a personal transformation. So great, you know, psychedelics, I can do that. I can personally transform. Spiritual practices, I can do that. I can personally transform. But you're also kind of holding out the idea that there can be this cultural transformation and that that's really possible. And I got to wonder, is it really possible in the society we live in the culture, in the post 9/11, in the, you know, flag waving, support our troops kind of culture that we have?
Well, you know, I mean, there are no total victories. Obama is a partial victory. Obama is a huge victory for the civil rights movement. Whatever he does as president is almost secondary, if you ask me. I mean,
I get you.
There are things that he does that I appreciate. There's a lot of things that he does that obviously I do not appreciate in the climate, political climate that we live in. I think, you know, he's made some choices and has some allies that I wouldn't have. Right. At the same time, the simple fact that he won and then won again in the same country that where Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were shot 50 years earlier, to me, as a sign of change, it's massive. It's massive. And you got to take your wins. If you don't take your wins and accept them, frankly, for the victories that they are, you're really impoverishing your own sense of what kind of change is possible.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Akaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to look into the consciousness culture shift that seems to be all around us. So many of the people we talk to on this show are certain that we are in this major shift of consciousness, enlightenment, paradigm shifting science away from materialism. As you know, if you listen to this show, I'm always a little bit skeptical of that and skeptical of whether this explosion of information that has undoubtedly come about mainly as a result of the internet, whether that fits into a true larger global historical context of some kind of massive change that people will look back on and put their finger on and go, ah, that's the point where everything changed. So those are some of the topics we talk about with today's guest, who is extremely well qualified to talk about all this, Ken Jordan from Reality Sandwich, one of the founders of Reality Sandwich, a website and a media hub that has really positioned itself, which has really positioned itself as somewhat of a hub for this consciousness culture shifting revolution kind of thing. So it was great to talk to Ken. We had a lot of fun talking about not only psychedelics and spirituality and consciousness, but also how that relates to some political issues. And Ken has a bit of a background in politics, having worked in D.C. And he tells a story about being on the Hill when he actually had the final push of motivation to go off and do Reality Sandwich. He has a very interesting background, very smart guy, very likable guy. And I think you'll enjoy this dialogue we have coming up. Hey, but before we get there, let me introduce to you a filmmaker named Barak Shavit, who contacted me about a film project he's trying to get off the ground. He has a Indiegogo campaign. He's trying to raise a few bucks to do this film project. I looked at the teaser. It looks like a great film. So I asked him to come on and say just a quick few words about it, and hopefully we all chip in a little money. He can make this film, and we can have him back on when he's done with it. Barak, welcome. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
First of all, thank you very much for having me, Alex. The movie that we're making is about consciousness. I've been making films for 6 years now, but it's so hard to find movies that actually deals with consciousness. We want to change that. And this is why we have I Syndrome, which is a movie that explores consciousness and mind, and then the whole movie is actually through a perspective of NDE.
Great. Well, we'll certainly have a link in the show notes to Barak's project on Indiegogo. I Syndrome is the name of the film. Check that out. But in the meantime, stick around for my dialogue with Ken Jordan. Today we welcome Ken Jordan to Skeptico. Ken is the co-founder of the very popular website and consciousness culture hub, Reality Sandwich. He's been a pioneer in online media for a number of years and is someone who is in a great position to tell us what's going on with this consciousness revolution that seems to be happening all around us. Ken, it's great to have you on Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex. It's really great to be here. Appreciate it.
Okay, so I don't want to start with a tough question, but since I just teed this up a few seconds ago when we were chatting, you got to help me through this. Allen Ginsberg poem, A Naked Lunch is Natural to Us, We Eat Reality Sandwiches. What's a reality sandwich?
Well, this is where the name came from. I originally started Reality Sandwich with Daniel Pinchbeck, a writer, who, you know, we were old friends, and both of us had roots in the Beat Generation. My father was the publisher and editor of Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs back in the 50s and 60s. And Daniel's mother dated Jack Kerouac when On the Road came out, and was also wrote a wonderful book called Minor Characters about being a woman in that very male beat scene of the 50s and 60s. And so for us, the beats and the culture that they were part of and the visions that they had of the transformed, much more spiritually engaged, less materialistic, open-hearted, beatific society that played a big role in the shaping of our understanding of what the world is really about. And Ginsberg in particular is a real teacher for us. And I knew Allen very, you know, really actually quite well. I lived in his apartment at one point when I was looking for when I had no place to live. I was sort of stranded, thrown out of an apartment by an ex-girlfriend, and called up Ginsberg. And he said, oh, you can stay here, and stayed there for a couple of months. I knew him really quite well, and he's an important teacher for me. So it was Daniel's idea to use the name Reality Sandwich for the magazine, for the online magazine when we started. And the poem that it comes from, of course, it was both a book of a collection of poems by Ginsberg from, I think, like 63, called Reality Sandwiches, plural. The poem itself is called On Burroughs' Work. And it's about his response, or it's prompted by his response to the writing that became Naked Lunch, which is a very in-your-face, obviously, very challenging to sort of mainstream societal norms. It was a very powerful, visionary, dark, engagement with the more sort of the beast side of experience. And Ginsberg was, in this very short poem, he refers to the importance of, our needing to eat reality sandwiches as a way of engaging with the naked lunch that is existence. If you pay attention, if you actually see what's at the end of your fork, I think that's a line. I don't have the poem in front of me, and I haven't actually looked at it for a number of years. But as I remember, that's part of the poem, is actually saying, look at what's on your fork. Pay attention to what's in front of you. Notice what it is that you're taking into your body and consciousness.
I think it's just interesting on a number of levels, because the whole idea of reality, of course, is something that play with at Reality Sandwich, but you don't. I mean, you try and probe it in a thoughtful way, and we certainly do on this show, because as soon as you start challenging the kind of conventional status quo understanding of what consciousness is, you just hit this brick wall and you go, you guys, you're not talking about anything real here. You're talking about, this biological robot meme that just doesn't make any sense. But that reality thing gets tougher the more we try and pull it apart. It's like a yarn, you pull the string on the ball of yarn and it just keeps unraveling and unraveling.
Yeah, well, reality effectively is a convention. you know, whatever reality means, I have no idea. It's a problematic word.
Exactly.
In many ways.
Exactly. Tell me this, Ken, because, you know, I did read about a little bit about your background, and I think it's very cool that you have this kind of beat psychedelic background that came to your home. You know, I mean, this was part of what you lived and grew up in. And I think my experience is that, the reverberations of that still can be found, and you've certainly tried to revive them. But in terms of your own personal experience, what did that path mean for you? And did you kind of get away from that, and did you feel a need to revive it, or what happened to you personally with that?
I got to say, I don't even know where to begin with that one. It made things pretty complicated, I think, for me in a lot of ways. My father was very much at the center of the beat scene, 60s counterculture, just in terms of his relationships, the way he saw the world, his own understanding of what it is to live a successful and engaged life in at a time when the corporate commercial consumer culture was so deadening. And
But you had to be someone who lived through the huge upswing of the corporate Wall Street greed is good kind of thing. I mean, you're there in New York City, and you're of a different generation. So, I mean, I think it had to be very confusing for you.
It was. I'm sorry. I paused for a second because I'm in somebody else's office, and it looked like they were about to come in and occupy the space. So I had to suggest that I need a little bit of time here to chat with you. I'm sorry I got distracted. So for me, growing up, I was born in 61, and I identified very strongly with the 60s counterculture hippie movement, which was, you know, very much in my home as I was a kid. And to see that not just as something that comes because, you know, it was just sort of happening as part of the zeitgeist, but that it needed to be catalyzed by folks who are taking real risks. So my father, as a publisher, he was the editor at Grove Press. He and the owner of the company, Barney Rossett, really, you know, shared a vision of a transformed society, which really at the time was only possible through the subversion of the mainstream, the subversion of the existing cultural head, which was at that time, you know, very different than it is now, right? You can't imagine back then that we would have gay marriage and a black president and, you know, all kinds of things that are really, you know, signs of a transformed society in many ways, in many positive ways. Certainly there was no alternative spiritual practice that had much following in the way that we today have, you know, so many people involved with Buddhism and different you know, engaged spiritual practices outside of the church, traditional old school church and whatnot. And they risked their, you know, a great deal by publishing books that were banned by the government. And they had to go to court to publish books like Lady Chatterley's Lover, Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller, Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. And there were other obscenity trials that they were involved in too. The books at the time were literally illegal to sell in America because of their content. And if they had lost the court cases that they engaged in, they could have gone to jail. And so that was a part of my upbringing. They also published a number of very controversial political figures, including Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, which led to the government doing quite an extensive COINTELPRO program against them. The COINTELPRO was the secret CIA FBI surveillance operation of the time that was, you know, against, you know, many figures who were in the progressive movement, you know, from Martin Luther King through, you know, all kinds of, you know, progressive activists and anti-war movement figures, civil rights figures and whatnot. Grove Press was the only company that was a target of COINTELPRO. It was the only actual, like, for-profit business. And there are 10,000 pages of blacked-out documents that we eventually got through Freedom of Information Act filing. The office was actually bombed in, I think it was 68, by anti-Castro Cubans who were working with the CIA. It was a rocket shot by the out of the back of the pickup truck, flatbed truck, actually. I think it was a rocket launcher, shot a rocket through the third floor window of the office building on the corner of 11th Street and University Place in Manhattan.
Wow, and you're a 7-year-old kid, right? So it's not like you can probably remember at least the commotion around that, huh?
Oh, I remember it really well because my dad got on TV. He was interviewed on the news about that. So I was like, oh wow. You know, I remember actually that morning when he got the call that the office had been bombed and he had to go in and talk to the police and figure out what was going on. I remember that very well, actually. So that was very much a part of my upbringing. So it was about engagement, understanding that you need that things like the 60s movement of that did not just happen organically because there was a wave of culture that somehow picked people up and, you know, changed their heads. It was, in fact, that certain people had to take risks and put themselves out front, doing things that might help to catalyze other people to come along and really make the change happen. So that's been a big part of my life. At the same time, I'm growing up with this kind of example and people like Abby Hoffman, who they also at Grove Press, they worked with. And my dad actually, edited and published his memoir. Abby lived in our basement when he was wanted by the FBI. And so he was one of the people who was giving me advice about where to go to college, right? I mean, this is like the how. It wasn't essentially I was getting career advice from Abby Hoffman, effectively. Right. Then the 80s happened. Excuse me. It makes me choke just to think about it. So it was a very strange place to be in my teens and 20s. Seeing the world through a lens which was really out of sync with where the center of the culture had shifted to this idea of greed is good, Reagan was president, Wall Street was an objective that people in college actually wanted to, you know, achieve. They wanted to get on Wall Street and make money doing what seemed to me to be not necessarily a particularly productive way of leading a life. And the alternative cultural movements that really had attracted so much high voltage intelligence and so many high powered figures who essentially abandoned their traditional career paths, those folks were not showing up in my generation in the same way to support an oppositional sort of alternative lifestyle and political movement. So I was kind of lost, frankly, I think, for much of the 80s and into the 90s. Didn't really understand exactly where I should be putting my attention. I did a lot of activist work. I ended up coordinating the New York City anti-war movement during the first Gulf War in 1961.
Good for you. Not 61, you mean?
61, God, that's a flip, a confusion. But no, I mean 1991, the first Persian Gulf War. I worked a lot. I was blessed in many ways because I spent a lot of time in the downtown New York arts and poetry and politics scene and learned a tremendous amount from people like, you know, Art Spiegelman, who is the artist and writer who did a book called Mouse, which is sort of a key graphic novel about the Holocaust. And he and his wife, Francoise Mouly, did a series of books in the magazine called Raw Books and Graphics, Raw Magazine, an important graphics comics magazine at the time. I worked with them as an assistant. I had a lot of interesting connections then to people who were, I think, really powerful cultural figures. Richard Foreman, I worked with him. Richard Foreman is an avant-garde theater playwright and director, really kind of a key figure if you're interested in the avant-garde in America in the last, 40, 50 years. I wrote a book with him together. So I did a lot of stuff that was really remarkable and fun and fascinating. But, you know, it also was frustrating because it didn't really engage the center of the culture. And the center of the culture was really, the attention was elsewhere. And that, so that was, for me, it was a little hard. You know, I dropped out of college. I never finished college. Because, you know, my background was the guys who I talked to about career advice, like Abby Hoffman, you don't need a degree. What are you going to do with a degree? And I think it made my life a little more difficult, actually. Looking back, I wish I had just finished and gotten the college degree. Would have been, there's a lot of things I could have done that would have been, where that would have been helpful, having it just to refer to, let alone having a master's or something like that.
I mean, maybe that kind of tees up this whole mess of, you know, culture and culture change. You know, and as you were saying that, we haven't talked a lot about the 60s or that whole thing on this show, but there's a couple of touchstones that I think are interesting. I heard an interview not too long ago with Timothy Leary, and this was an older interview right after he had gotten out of prison. And one of the things he said, it was just a minor point, but it always stuck with me. He said that, you know, he was out doing his whole thing, you know, and we're going to change everything and tune in, turn on, drop out, you know, the whole thing. And he said, I didn't realize at the time, but we had been completely co-opted, you know, that we had been infiltrated and co-opted by the FBI and the CIA and the guys who I was talking with, my group, some of them were part of that group, you know.
Well, so it's interesting you use the word co-opted. I'd be I didn't know Leary personally, so I don't know him, but I would be surprised if he used that word. Infiltrated, for sure, right? And then something happened later. Something happened in the 80s and 90s. Where the surface style and the attitude of the 60s movement became acquired by the CEO type, you know, corporate culture.
Completely.
Right, of the period. And so where it had been fairly easy in the 60s and early 70s to know, quote unquote, like who's in the movement and who's real and like part of the change. And really making a personal life choice about participating and contributing to a change that is, you know, I think critical for the spiritual life of the society. It became much different later when HIP became corporate, basically.
But I think what he was alluding to and what I see all the time is the you're right about the outward manifestation of that co-opting, you know, and McDonald's is psychedelic. You know, at some point in the 70s, you know, Ronald McDonald had, you know, a tie-dye wig on. I seem to remember that at some point. You know, it's completely co-opting. But what he saw was that this is the first step of this, you know, and I think we always have to be kind of look, when we talk about culture change and culture shift and consciousness culture, and, you know, I'm very interested in that and talking to people about that, but I'm also constantly on guard, you know, for a kind of eternal vigilance for how is this being co-opted or how does it have the potential to be co-opted? You know, and I think it's really easy to gloss over these things and say, oh, you know, transformational society and look how much better we are. It's like, hey, you mentioned the FOIA Act and how you got 10,000 pages of whatever. Go get those 10,000 pages today. You can't get crap out of the FOIA Act. And don't take our African-American / black president and hold him up as any example. He's the one who squashed all that stuff. And he's the one who just not only rubber stamped, but kind of further promoted, you know, all the important right stripping that were endorsed and supported by his predecessor, you know, the Bush and Cheney regime.
Oh, yeah.
So
absolutely.
I think
absolutely.
What a lot of people are trying to figure out in this transformational consciousness transformation thing that you guys are so much about in terms of Reality Sandwich, that's who you are. They want to know what's real. They want to know what's real. And they want to know what's real from kind of two angles. I think one side, we get it from a personal transformation. So great, you know, psychedelics, I can do that. I can personally transform. Spiritual practices, I can do that. I can personally transform. But you're also kind of holding out the idea that there can be this cultural transformation and that that's really possible. And I got to wonder, is it is it really possible in the society we live in the culture, in the post 9/11, in the, you know, flag waving, support our troops kind of culture that we have?
Well, you know, I mean, there are no total victories. Obama is a partial victory. Obama is a huge victory for the civil rights movement. Whatever he does as president is almost secondary, if you ask me. I mean,
I get you.
Things that he does that I appreciate. There's a lot of things that he does that obviously I do not appreciate. In the climate, political climate that we live in, I think, you know, he's made some choices and has some allies that I wouldn't have. Right. At the same time, the simple fact that he won and then won again in the same country that where Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were shot 50 years earlier, to me, as a sign of change, it's massive. It's massive. And you got to take your wins. If you don't take your wins and accept them, frankly, for the victories that they are, you're really impoverishing your own sense of what kind of change is possible. In many ways, you can look at the movements of the 60s and see, frankly, some serious wins that have transformed not just American culture, but the culture of the world in a very positive way. The opening that came out of the 60s, psychedelic culture, led to a very different understanding of spirituality that is possible now in America, that was unthinkable back then. It's not simply like, oh, I took some, and listen, a lot of people take psychedelics and they don't get their opening. They don't get their awakening, you know? But there's a lot more people who are having interesting awakenings at this point outside of the restrictive confines of traditional religious practices that my sense is, and this is one of the interesting things about, you know, having the gig that I've got, is my sense is that this is unprecedented in American culture. And that is, and I think, a direct continuation of what happened in the 1960s. But this isn't just about the 60s. These things go on, you know, that kind of opening, that kind of engagement and awakening. Listen, this is something that's been popping up through the culture, through societies, throughout history. These are deep currents. And there are moments where the spiritual energy breaks through and becomes more present, and there are moments where it becomes more oppressed and under the surface. And what happened in the 60s was part of a much larger wave that goes way, way back, and it peaks and it comes down. It peaks and it comes down.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit, because I think that's one of the things that people try and get a handle on when they're trying to judge where they're at in this ocean of kind of changing cultural trends. You know, where are we in this cultural, in this consciousness revolution that we keep hearing so much about from so many different people and from so many different parts of society? Where are we? You just referenced that we might be on the tail end of something that happened in the 60s. I think most people can kind of feel that a little bit, but you're also trying to put it in a larger context. I'm not so sure we always see that. Well, what is your take on that larger context that we're in, and where does that reverberate across other cultures and other times?
Well, what's interesting now is I feel like something's happening. I think a lot of people I talk to feel the same thing, where there's a greater opening and awareness towards an engagement with a higher vibration of consciousness, and what that might mean in many different aspects of life. It's coming through in science. It's coming through in people's practices, thanks partially to a kind of this neo-shamanistic movement, people working with ayahuasca. There's like a very strong engagement with what is now being called popularly mindfulness practice, which is to say meditation, sitting still and noticing what's going on in your head, is now something that's becoming increasingly common across the country. You've got, you know, obviously many people doing yoga. A lot of the yoga practice is just a glorified kind of Pilates, but for some people, the yoga is a gateway to something else that leads them to go deeper into themselves and to understand their interconnection with, through their breath, with all things that are going on around them. People are having Kundalini openings at a kind of unprecedented rate. When Gopti Chupa, now I'm totally spacing his name out, but the guy who wrote the first book about Kundalini. Gopi Krishna. Gopi Krishna?
Is that I'm sorry, I'm not I should sure. know
this. Okay. But this was a book that was written around in the 30s, right? Mm-hmm. He's writing about his Kundalini opening, Kundalini awakening, and the challenge of it and how it completely flipped him out and how difficult it was for him to hold it for years and eventually developing a practice where he could hold it.
I remember that book.
The fascinating thing was that at that time, he did a lot of research. There's like 2, 3, 4 references to Kundalini awakenings in the literature at that point. Very few people had had that experience. You know, now it's happening. Like, people are having extraordinary, I mean, like the numbers of people that I meet who have had some kind of Kundalini opening right now, it's jaw-dropping, right? And this wasn't happening 100 years ago.
We don't know to what extent it was not happening or not being reported. It's certainly probably a mix of both. And the internet has a huge force to play in this, which we all acknowledge. But that doesn't take away from the fact that what you're saying is kind of hard to dispute on any level. And so what does that mean? You're right in the middle of defining what that means with your venture Reality Sandwich and EvolverNet. What do you think that means for your community, and how are you reacting to it?
Well, all we're trying to do is really reflect what's going on around us, what we see, right? And provide a platform for it to be expressed so that other folks can notice it and the people who are in the scene can identify each other and go like, oh, look at what so-and-so is doing. And I see connection between this thing and that thing. There's connection between, you know, people working with plant medicine and folks who are interested in meditation practices and folks who are interested in, you know, the new forms of social governance and that are, you know, far more egalitarian than alternatives to, you know, traditional forms of currency. I mean, like, frankly, you see that these, when you start to go deeper into consciousness and it awakens you to your interconnection with all that there is, you understand your sense of responsibility, taking care of the universe that you have, you know, been born into. And the planet is in a crisis, deep, deep crisis. The environment certainly is the forefront of that crisis, what's happening to all of the living beings on the planet. There's so many different indicators now that give us a reason to be deeply concerned.
Expand on that a little bit. I mean, I'm not so sure that I totally buy into that from a historical basis. I mean, I look at some statistics that certainly back that up. You know, I live right on the coast, and you go out there in the ocean and the fish aren't there anymore, and we've completely decimated that. Yet, if we look historically, we've kind of done that over and over again, and we do find a way out of it from a larger kind of context, and certainly from a spiritual context. I mean, I don't know
when
how
you say we've done this over and over again. What do you mean? Like,
if you look at when Plymouth Rock landed on all of us, all the indigenous trees in the East are gone, right? I mean, they're completely gone, and then we completely decimated the forest, and we've done this over and over again. Not that it's a good thing, but I mean, we've lived through.
I don't actually agree. I think there's a quantitative difference between the domestication of you know, where people live, and the effect that we've had, human beings have had on, you know, the topography and the plants and, you know, and animals in our environment. Obviously, you know, throughout history, there's been clearly, you know, like the dodo bird died, and, you know, there's certain trees probably are less plentiful than other trees, and, you know, definitely there's elements of that. But what's happening right now is unique.
Well, we
in terms
can't
of the last
say
65
we just,
million.
We just can't we have say a, that. I just don't well, think why, we can say that.
Because there's a tremendous amount of science now, research into the level, the rate, the extinction rates. I mean, this is, you know, you can argue about exactly, you know, little, you know, aspects of that, but the vast level of disruption that climate change and the toxicity levels in our environment, because we're pumping poisons into the environment at an unprecedented rate, and the effect that the ozone had for a while, now it seems to be starting to get corrected, but there's a lot of deep challenges to the environment that are being tracked by, you know, scientists globally, in a pretty responsible way. And there's a deep consensus among those scientists about.
Oh man, I mean, I think it's just hard to pull all that apart. Some of that I can definitely agree with. And if someone was to put my feet to the fire and say, has human activity contributed to global warming and a change in our environment, I'd have to say yes. But to the extent that that's been driven as some kind of alarmist mechanism to foster this carbon trading scheme that was just really designed to create another currency and create a trillions of dollar boon for a small group of people who are then standing in the way of another group of big oil, big energy people who are on the other side. But I think the extent to which we think we understand that game and how it's being played and how it's reflected in our science, I think we're naive to think we understand that. And so that's my one challenge with it, is that I think until we really understand who's pulling the strings and we look at where the money's flowing, we don't get it. But my other problem with it is there's a fundamentally very materialistic kind of play there at the end of the road. It gets us away from spirituality, ultimately, that says that we're really not in control and our life isn't what we think it is, to saying, oh no, God needs our help in this one. We got to all get together and do something, you know, and we have to go, and eventually it'll lead to, well, we have to go bomb somebody, just like we killed a million women and children in Iraq because we weren't sure whether they had their weapons of mass destruction. So what did we do? We sanctioned them. That was a good thing. We sanctioned them for however many dozens of years we sanctioned them. And in the process of sanctioning them, we killed all these people by refusing them basic medical needs. So I'm just not comfortable kind of making those, from a scientific standpoint, making those leaps that we know so much and we're in so much control.
Well, I got to say, in my own practice, my own spiritual practice, which involves the use of plant medicines, I have had extremely powerful and subjective experiences where I feel my attention has been brought to the suffering of the planet, the suffering experience of the of life on this planet as a result of human action. And that has made me acutely sensitive to the beauty, our natural environment, our human existence as essentially, you know, part of that natural environment. We are an extension of, or negate, you know, essentially the flowering of that, of the environment in which we've been born and developed. We are nature, and that what happens to nature affects us, that we're not separate from that. And so for me, that's actually been a very beautiful and empowering experience, to really lock into the energy and the communication that can come from plants, from animals, and to feel myself responding to that, sensitive enough to notice it and to have a visceral experience of that, for me has been very special. It may be my total imagination, it may be my subjective, you know, projection, but I'm having these experiences and they're really gorgeous. And they've made me understand that in order for me to live the kind of life that I would like to live, it's important to not get overly attached to the material, to stuff, to objects, to money, to all the crap that you can accumulate in your life. You know, obviously you want to have some basic things taken care of, right? It's important to have a warm place to sleep at night that's comfortable. And I got a kid, so I want my kid to be fed and, you know, all of that. And so there's some basic things, but beyond the basics, it's really, most of it is not that critical. And that there's something else to really connect to and to nurture yourself with. That's how I relate to it.
Right? And I think that's awesome. I really do. And I think that personal transformation is all there really is. The part that I am challenged by and am kind of challenging you on is the next step of that to action, particularly in terms of public political action, but also in terms of policy action. I think it gets really, really murky really fast. You know, I mean, we live in America, love it or leave it kind of culture, you know, in terms of we're talking about Obama and, hey, it's we have to. I like what you said, by the way. You know, we have to celebrate our victories. But I think we have to be very humble about what those victories really mean. I mean, we're talking about the environment and we're talking about, you know, driving our Prius and, you know, our hybrid cars and all that. But we dumped over a ton a day of depleted uranium missiles fired from our tanks into the Iraqi desert. Now, why did we even have to do that? Forget the war. Why did we have to use depleted uranium? Why did we have to destroy this environment for centuries forward? So I think we can never fully take in, you know, no matter how much we want to take in the pain and suffering of the world, which I think is something that we have to do in our personal practice, I don't think we can fully take it in. And I don't think we can fully take ownership of just how much our life, you know, our privileged life here in the United States is really still built on the back of a lot of suffering of other people. I'm not saying I have any solution for that at all. In fact, I'm saying just the opposite. But what I think it transitions into me is getting at the core feeling that I think is also a part of this consciousness revolution. And that's a feeling of first estrangement and alienation with our culture, because you know what? I don't want us to go drop depleted uranium missiles on people. I was never for that. And whatever I have to do to stop that, I'm willing to do it, but there's nothing I can really do. I don't feel empowered to do it. But then number two, I think there becomes a hopelessness associated with that. You know, it's like, wow, the world isn't the way that I think it is, and there's nothing I can really do to change it. How do you fit into that? How can the consciousness hub of people trying to make that shift, what is that community to do? And how can that community make that shift for themselves, that personal transformation?
Well, that's a question I had to face for myself after the Gulf War, and I worked in book publishing for a while. I got involved with the internet very early, and I started the first online music magazine, multimedia zine, also first online music digital store. It was called SonicNet. Back in 94, 95, eventually was bought by MTV. I became a digital consultant person eventually, working for foundations and not-for-profits. I worked with Amnesty International. I worked with Witness, which is Peter Gabriel's human rights organization. I conceived the idea of a hub where you could one could upload human rights videos and be safe. Essentially, you know, videos of human rights transgressions and be protected, right, in case you're in places where that's not going to be necessarily a healthy thing to do. And did a lot of work in that world for many years, including working with, you know, Democrats in Congress and whatnot. And in the early days of the Obama campaign, I knew a number of people who got involved with it. I could have also gotten involved and worked, you know, in that world much more closely. But that was also when we were starting Reality Sandwich. And I clearly had a fork in the road moment where I had to decide, where am I going to put my attention? Am I going to try to work in policy and in a system that feels to me to be deeply corrupt and perhaps, you know, frankly, you know, really almost impossible to seriously move the needle on, and end up incredibly frustrated with it, with my inability to have any meaningful impact? Or am I going to leap into this other world, really an unknown kind of world, where we were identifying a new cultural movement that was coming out of this sort of consciousness scene? I think of it as essentially the post-New Age consciousness scene, right? Next generation, which was, to me, from what I was seeing and still see, much more politically engaged, making a connection between your own consciousness advancement, your own spiritual work, and a responsibility for what's happening to your community and to the planet. Just do what I could to help that grow and become more articulated and help the people who are seeing, like you were saying, alienated from the mainstream culture, enable them to find one another so that they can start to organize and become a presence in their communities. And I decided that, you know, for me, really, there was no option. I just had to, I had to chuck it, the career that I had been building. You know, at one point, it was kind of an amazing moment. I was working for the Democrats in Congress, developing a system for them, online systems, a techie consultant person. And sitting at Steny Hoyer's desk, Steny Hoyer was the majority whip at that time. He had two offices. So he had one desk he didn't really use and another desk that where he really was doing his work. So I was able to use the desk that he was empty, effectively. It had some of his kids' photographs on it and whatnot, but it was basically empty. And I was sitting there between meetings in, you know, in D.C., looking out the window straight at the Capitol Dome, you know, surrounded by the pomp and circumstance of, you know, the D.C. political machine. And working on the very early days of Reality Sandwich at his desk, you know, for a couple of hours one day. And I got to say, the sort of the friction between these two worlds was so strong. I was feeling it very intensely. I was right. Like, if anybody walks in here and sees what I'm doing right now, man, my job is shot. I'm gone, right? But you know, nobody really cared. Nobody was paying attention. But it was a wonderful and bizarre place to be. But I feel that the only real change that is going to have a lasting impact at this point has got to happen on a heart by heart cultural level, and right. People have got to wake up, and they've got to get in touch with their love, and that's what's going to ultimately make the difference. And I know that sounds corny. I know you say that. And, you know, listen, I'm an old punk rocker, basically. It's hard for me to speak those kinds of words, but I'm not sure. You know, I got to find a better way to say it, basically. I just got to find a bit of Duncan Trussell does it really well, I think. He's the example. Duncan Trussell is defining the vocabulary, I think, for where this is all going to go. I love the way he does it.
Yeah, he does a great job.
Yeah, I got a lot to learn from him. So, but I think that's what's got to happen. And everybody I know who ended up working in the Washington machine and some of them in and out of the White House, man, they're all pissed off and frustrated. They're freaking out about like what a mess it is and how corrupt it is and what a disaster that system is.
Yeah, but I think one of the challenges we have is to make sure that this consciousness revolution that we're talking about doesn't become the same way and doesn't become co-opted, and that we have that eternal vigilance and we really see it as something different. And to me, that difference is it keeps coming back to this deep spirituality that is about personal transformation that then leads to, as you're saying, this heart by heart connection. But I think the outward expression of heart by heart, where I have to go out and I have to talk to you and I have to reach you and I have to connect with you, it's like, I don't think that works. I have to connect with myself and then shine through. Yeah. And then I think that's really what you're about. I think you've done a fabulous job with the website. And I think it truly is this information hub that when people go there, it isn't directing them towards a particular set of ideas or a particular stance. You know, it's not saying sign this petition. It's just a collection that you can find your own way and in the process connect with other people.
Well, you know, I want to challenge you for a second about the notion of co-optation, which is something that I was also extremely sensitive to for a very long time. But I'm wondering if it's not a useful concern. And here's how I come to that. Charles Eisenstein, who wrote a book called Sacred Economics that we published, Evolver Editions published. Evolver Editions is a book imprint that we do in collaboration with North Atlantic Books, which really came out of Reality Sandwich in many ways. Charles Eisenstein is also a writer we published regularly on Reality Sandwich for many years. His thought was that when the revolution comes, no one's going to remember after it happens who was on which side.
That's
Everybody's going to be on the same side. And it doesn't matter if, you know, the guys who were like, quote unquote, on the other side recognize that they were wrong and that I was right or you were right. And that they go and they capitulate, right? What matters is that we all end up in the same. And that if this happens the way it may well happen, there might never be a moment where the confrontation actually takes place. And what's interesting, he said this a number of years ago, and I actually was having a similar thought around the time I first read him writing about this idea. Something happened over the last couple of years to me that's really kind of fascinating, because I always had the notion that there's going to be this, essentially, we're working with an underground culture, an underground scene that is more connected to what life really is about, hard connected, working with compassion, but that we're always going to be somehow fighting against this massive, vicious, oppositional power structure that will always resist us and try to crush us. And that as we grow and bring more attention to what we do, they're going to come after us. They're going to bust down the door. Listen, I grew up under FBI surveillance and CIA mm-hmm. surveillance. So I always had this sense of, like, you know, they're paying it. You know, they're listening to everything.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking the day's going to come where they're going to come, you know, going to come after us. And, you know, I was waiting for the big sensationalist stories about ayahuasca as a, you know, as something that's like, you know, leading to the corruption of our youth. One thing after another, I can give you a long list of all of my paranoias. It hasn't happened. What's happening instead now, and this is what, it really forced me to reconsider some of my fundamental ideas about how cultural change is going to happen in this historical moment. What's happened instead is that many of the things that we were covering in Reality Sandwich when we started, which is literally, I think, 8 years ago this week, it's been 8 years since we started the magazine, topics like psychedelics, psi phenomena, alternative currencies, a long list of things that the plants, the power of plants, plant intelligence. These ideas were so fringy and so taboo at the time that we began that many of the people who I knew, most of my friends, frankly, who I had, you know, knew through the work that I had been doing in politics and in media in New York City over many years, thought that I had just jumped off the deep end and I was gone. And I couldn't talk to them about any of it. They just wrote me off. They said, I sent them the links to Reality Sandwich. I said, check out this new project. And I'm like, I never heard back. And that was it, man. Right, I stopped getting invitations to parties. And, you know, nobody ever talked to me about getting another job again. You know, like I was just like off the list, right? Now, those same people, some of those same people, not all of them, some of them, are coming to me and going, you know, I'm interested in going to Peru.
Yeah,
you
know? Right.
and more than that, you're seeing the media coverage of like CNN doing hour-long documentaries about, people with PTSD going to work with shaman in South America and having extraordinary recoveries, very positive coverage. The coverage has actually been really much better for many of the things that we thought were like off limits back then. And they were off limits back then. Something is changing. And, you know, the media coverage is just an anecdotal way of pointing to it. Another anecdotal way is what I'm encountering through the people I meet. Guys who've been running hedge funds for 15 years coming to me going like, man, you know, hey, I just went to Peru and my life has changed. I got to get out of Wall Street. I got to do something else with my life, you know. The whole, whole world has been turned upside down. This kind of people who I never expected to give the slightest credence to this, you know, quote unquote woo-woo alternative culture stuff, are having awakenings of different kinds that are profound and real. And I don't like to use the word real that much, frankly, but this feels very real to me. This is the reality that I'm engaging with, right? And it's still happening in a kind of undergroundish way. It's not really breaking through to mass consciousness yet, but there's so much of it going on that shift to me in mainstream conscious awareness is inevitable. It's going to happen. It may take 3 years. It may take 5 years. And what's interesting to me about this especially is that a lot of the sense of my needing to be the black leather jacket, punky, alternative culture, tough guy who's ready for the cops to break down the door, you know, like, that's not helpful for me anymore. It's not helping me do what I'm doing. They haven't come yet. Now, I know they may come. I know that something might happen. I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'm not making any predictions.
Well, but that's the difference between confrontation and co-option. First of all, don't be too, you know, adversarial or oppositional to your ideas, because I think it's undeniable what you're saying. And anyone who isn't tuned into that from a purely factual, statistical basis, you know, is just out of touch with what's going on. But I look at, you know, you mentioned just in passing there, psi and parapsychology, and that's something I've kind of delved into a lot on the show. You know, if you really look into that, there's a classic case of, I've seen the co-opting happen in the last 10 years, you know.
What do you mean by how is that co-opting?
I'll tell you exactly how it's co-opted. You know what parapsychology means now? It means anomalistic psychology. It means, why do people believe weird things? If you go over to one of the most celebrated, recognized schools in University of Edinburgh, completely run by skeptics who, you know, just published the other day, Carolyn Watt, one of the, I think the head of that department or a very prominent figure in it, just published another paper that someone put across my desk, kind of saying the same thing, you know, none of this stuff is real. Here's why people believe it and all that. You know, try and get a paper published in parapsychology. Look at who is in the parapsychology community anymore that's really in the parapsychology community. It's, you know, it's been decimated. And who is taking a prominent role in that community is a bunch of skeptics, materialists that are pushing the same old thing and are explaining away the phenomena. The same thing they're trying to do with a near-death experience as well. Now,
I mean, there's clearly going to be institutional setups,
right,
where certain people are going to work their way into the institution because there's the safety of a particular kind of job and a paycheck and institutional credibility from, you know, their peers. And they're going to corrupt it. That's the nature of some institutions. What's happening, though, I think on a larger scale, is a shift in attitude among many people in the culture. Near-death experiences, yeah, okay, you can look at, like, you know, this institution or that institution. The fact is that compare this to 30 years ago.
No doubt.
There's such a vast greater awareness about the possibility of reincarnation and what it means essentially to have some aspect of the self, some non-material aspect of the self that survives the body and moves into another body, however that might be. And frankly, we understand so little of this as human beings, but there's something here that there's a greater and greater consensus among folks who are open to having, you know, consciousness experiences. That's becoming, it's really a major shift. And, you know, we're about to, Evolver, among other things, does, Evolver is the parent company of Reality Sandwich, just to put it out there. Reality Sandwich is a magazine we publish every day on the internet. Let's say Monday to Friday, we publish long form articles and interviews, as well as shorter little newsy items about consciousness, consciousness culture. But we're published by a company called Evolver, which also helped to found, and you know, Evolver does many things, and among them is an online learning program called the Evolver Learning Lab. And Evolver Learning Lab does courses around the topics that, you know, Reality Sandwich really specializes in. We did a course last year with MAPS about psychedelic science and the research that's being done, medical research that's being done into psychedelics. We did a course with Dennis McKenna around plant intelligence, and we're about to do a course right now with Eben Alexander, who wrote the popular book Proof of Heaven, which really brought the discussion about near-death experiences into the mainstream recently in an extraordinary way. I think the book sold like a million copies.
Right.
And he's a very interesting and quite nuanced thinker about the topic when you really get into it with him. And his wife, Karen Newell, who is a sound therapy practitioner, who works with entrainment technologies, sound entrainment recordings that can help lead you into a state where you're open to higher states of consciousness. So that's it happens to be a course that we're just about to announce. We're actually announcing it today. There's, I think, a sea change in attitudes around these things among a certain group of people. And it is as topics, the stigma associated with them is lifting compared to just a few years ago. That's my experience of looking at working with this material, publishing about it, talking to the writers and researchers who are in these fields. There's psychedelic science, psychedelic research. I mean, compared to 5 years ago, it's a vast change.
No doubt.
The legalization of cannabis is part of this too.
I think the legalization of cannabis is probably one of the most important political acts in my lifetime that I can think of. And I'm not a cannabis user, but I still think the freedom for people to control their consciousness and or manipulate their consciousness in that way, and for the government to finally say, I'm out of that business a little bit, I think is huge.
It's a major thing. And I think it's just one aspect of a bigger shift, which has to do with our awareness of plants and the importance of connecting to plants, whole plants, rather than just sort of chemical extractions that, you see in the pharmaceutical world and the nutraceutical world, a kind of mechanistic model of the body that doesn't really understand our organic, or doesn't really appreciate the complexity of our organic nature and our spiritual nature, which is part of that, I think. And what's happening now because of the legalization of cannabis is a sign of a growing engagement with plants as a culture. I think I'm seeing that. I'm talking to a lot of people who are seeing something similar. I think it's very exciting.
Yeah, I do too. As we wrap up, I do have to just share with you just a tiny story that happened to me yesterday, because I think one of the topics we've been kind of struggling over is this idea of hope and hopelessness. And it's something that I think I like bringing out to the forefront, because I think it is reaching people where they really are. And I've felt, and I think a lot of other people have felt at different times, a certain sense of hopelessness with trying to make change, either personally, but in particular, trying to make change in culture, because making change in culture is really hard to do. But I was thinking about this word, and I was remembering a quote I heard from the venerated Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, and I remember this from a long time ago, reading one of his books, and how he was saying, hope is really, when you think about it, is an obstacle. So I'm searching for this quote because I wanted to talk to you about it and put it out on the table. And I keep searching on Google, and all I keep getting is this quote from Thich Nhat Hanh: hope is important because it can make the present moment less difficult to bear. And this quote is now repeated over and over again. I go, gosh, did I just get this wrong? But I kept having this gnawing feeling that that was half the quote. And eventually I found the whole quote. And so again, this is very Zen, but to me, I think it gets at the core of how we play with our change, both our change and how we play with letting go and the deeper spiritual part. Because he says hope is important because it can make the present less difficult to bear. But then he says it can also be a trap. It takes our energies away from the present moment, and it becomes a kind of obstacle because we are constantly hoping and we're not doing the business of changing ourselves. I guess I think both are true. I think it's, as you said earlier, I think it's really important to celebrate where we can move forward and other people who are moving forward. But I just hate to take the focus away from the real work that we all have to do. I think it seems obvious is that the transformation has to come from within.
I totally agree. I think it's about looking inside and being open to what comes through once you do your best to let go of your own projections and ego. And I mean, this is what any meaningful spiritual practice ultimately gets you to. Hope is funny because, it's not something I think about. I just don't think about hope. I think you got to respond to the moment. You got to stay in this, in where you're at, and do what feels right and do what feels good. And if you know when something doesn't feel right to you, if it doesn't feel right to you, don't do it. That's how I live my life. You know, maybe that's not the best way to live a life, but that's how I try to live my life. And stay as close as you can to your most naive and open and loving and compassionate self, which again, you know, the punk rocker in me vomits when I say this, but that's what I actually feel like I'm doing as best I can in my totally flawed and fumbly, ridiculous New York Jew intellectual, cerebral, you know, fucked up way. So one of the beautiful things about this moment is that, you know, of course, we live in an extraordinary moment of tremendously ironic culture, right?
Yes.
Because we know that the pure expression of these sentiments is bullshit, right? You can't just latch onto them, and you certainly can't just act it. Like you were saying, the co-optation thing, the danger of co-optation is that there's a surface way of expressing
exactly
this way of being that anybody can copy and then commodify and sell. You can't do that, though, at a deep level. But this, you know, it just doesn't, at the deep level, the real thing, you can't do that to it. Again, going back to the Ginsberg and, you know, my teachers, who I think really wrestled with this issue in many ways because they went from being obscure, poor, you know, outsider figures mm-hmm. to eventually becoming kind of iconic figures mm-hmm. who had commercial value, right? And which was not what they expected when they started out. And when, you know, towards the end of his life, Ginsberg was actually asked to be in a couple of a Gap ad, I don't remember, some stupid thing like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, they gave him $100,000 for it, and he used it to fund the Rope Institute, which is a Buddhist school where he had a writing program. And so, you know, for him, it was directly like, just, you know, hey, give me cash, I'll be in an ad. Nobody ever asked him to be in an ad in the 50s and 60s when he was really at his height of power because he was too volatile, he was too dangerous. Nobody, advertising at that point was frightened of him. But then he became a much more kind of, you know, recognized figure. Was he being co-opted by being in that ad? Okay. From his perspective, it was all about what he wrote. Ultimately, people are going to come back to the poems. They're going to look at Howell. They're going to look at Kaddish and the other things that he'd done. They're going to look at his political work and his history if they actually paid attention that to go that deep and see his role in as a cultural activist and political activist. That's what speaks, right? It's you do the stuff right at a deep level, and it has its integrity. And anybody who's paying attention will see the integrity. There's always going to be fellow traveler type, co-op type folks who just don't engage with that, and they're coming along for the ride, or they're not even coming along for the ride. They're kind of just playing it out because it's going to get them laid or get them rich or something. And, you know, you got to just maneuver with that the best you can. But the real deal is how many more people can you turn on at a deep level, right? Mm-hmm. That's what's going to make the difference.
Yeah, so how many more people can we turn on at a deep level? That's a pretty cool question, and I guess that's what you're trying to do at Reality Sandwich and Evolver.net. Where should people go to find out more about this? Obviously, Reality Sandwich. And then if they want what more the educational kind of component of it, is that why they'd go to Evolver.net?
If you're interested in the online courses, please come by EvolverLearningLab.com. EvolverLearningLab.com is where we do, you know, we right now have two classes that we're offering. We're about to announce a couple more. We also have a series of free talks, usually with folks who are in the herbal and specialists in herbalism, botanical remedies, and plants and permaculture. And that's a series that we've been holding with some really amazing people. That's connected to a program that we have on Evolver.net. Evolver.net is essentially sort of the home base for the range of things that we do, and it's also our online marketplace. We offer products that come from the community that we're a part of. Many of them would be of interest to the community, but many of them are made by people who are directly in the kind of evolver reality sandwich scene. In particular, we have an area of specialty in herbal and botanical remedies from small makers, independent makers of these products from around the country, mostly in places like Vermont and Maine and Oregon, and where they're doing small batches of really beautiful herbal and botanical products that can help you with, say, you know, they're like dream elixirs different kinds of calming or aphrodisiac type remedies of different kinds. They're really kind of amazing. And they're made by these folks who are almost like poets, making small batches of really beautiful, beautiful stuff, which were brought together initially through evolver.net, and then now through a new website that we've just recently launched called The Alchemist's Kitchen, which also has some news and blog posts around this territory of herbal and botanical the plant world. And then we also have a not-for-profit network called the Evolver Network of local groups, the Evolver Spores. The Evolver Spores came out of initially a reality sandwich when we started. It was people started emailing us saying, hey, you know, I'm in, you know, Boise, I'm in Salt Lake City, I'm reading Reality Sandwich. Like, is there anybody else here who like gets what the hell is what's going on here? Like, I'm having these experiences, I'm interested in this material, and everybody else I know, you know, my family, my friends, my coworkers all think I'm crazy and I have nobody to talk to. Like, who do I talk to? So we started putting these folks in touch with one another, and eventually led to this network of about 30 local groups around the country that it's become an amazing incubator of community activism and engagement on a local level around consciousness and culture. So if you go to the evolvernetwork.org, I think it's just evolvernetwork.org. There's no the evolvernetwork.org. You can find the group that's near you, or you can suggest that you'd like to start one yourself and get connected to the sporganizers around the country who are putting together the Evolver Spores. It's a really inspirational program.
That's awesome. And we'll definitely link up to a lot of those programs you have going on here in the show notes. Well, Ken, it's really been great having you on the show, and I appreciate such an open, kind of wide-ranging dialogue. Obviously, best of luck with Reality Sandwich and of all the Evolver stuff, and I'm sure we'll definitely stay in touch. So thanks for joining me.
That's great, Alex. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks again to Ken Jordan from Reality Sandwich for joining me today on Skeptico. The one obvious question to tee up from this interview is, are we in the middle of a consciousness culture shift? Or is it just more navel-gazing by a bunch of folks like you and I who love the internet and love the explosion of information that's come about, but in the grander historical worldwide sense, beyond our little culture here in the West, maybe none of this stuff makes much of a difference. So let me know your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can send me a note, drop a comment, or jump on over to the forum and join in the discussion there. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. A couple of kind of controversial debate-like shows will be the next couple out. I hope you enjoy them. Please stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.